All right. Welcome to Digging a Hole, the Legal Theory Podcast. On this podcast, my co-host Sam Moyne and I, David Schleicher, talk about legal theory and whatever else is on our mind. And we're super excited about today's episode. We have one of my mentors and great friends, Rick Pildes from NYU Law School, and kind of the creator and developer of the field of the law of democracy, talking to us about fragmentation in political democracies in the West, the causes of that, the effects of it. It's a really wonderful discussion, very wide ranging. You get to hear Sam be an optimist, which is unusual. So it's a real climbic. It's really fun. I can't wait for you all to hear it. Okay, let's get to it. We are so happy to have Rick Pildes joining us today. Rick is the Sudler Family Professor of Constitutional Law at NYU and one of, if not the, leading scholar in our country about the legal issues concerning democracy. His casebook and scholarship really inaugurated the field of law and democracy kind of as a field of study. He's also our only guest, I think, who's ever won an Emmy, I'm pretty sure, as a part of the NBC team covering Bush vs. Gore, and is a regular columnist for the New York Times, among other places. Rick was also my professor in law school and someone to whom I owe a deep debt of gratitude, not only for being a terrific mentor, but also for being a great sport about being the critical target of my first ever law review article. So thank you for that. In recent years, Rick has written a great deal about polarization and related problems around the world, and that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk specifically about his terrific new article, Political Fragmentation in Democracies of the West. We're also, if there's time, going to talk about his work on reforming the Electoral Count Act. So welcome to the pod, Rick.
Thank you guys very much for having me. I'm embarrassed that I have to correct one thing you said, which is I was nominated with NBC for an Emmy, but we didn't actually win the Emmy for our coverage of the 2000 presidential election. So
you were robbed. It's my fault. You won in our eyes. So we'll provide you with a mug, which isn't exactly an Emmy Award trophy, but we'll provide you with a Digging a Hole mug. Yeah, hopefully, it replaces that in your house.
It's a greater value.
Is it a statue or is it just a mug?
It's a mug and a T-shirt and a pen.
Oh,
so
my gosh.
Lots of swag. Rick, the new article kind of picks up a lot of themes from your 2013-14 Elliott lectures at Yale. I mean, it focuses how across the world, or at least across the developed countries of the US and Europe, politics has kind of fallen apart, and particularly how centrist and establishment political authority has collapsed and, in your terms, fragmented. And this has led to an inability for governments across these layers to get things done for their citizens. What is the evidence that this has happened?
Yeah, so back when I first started writing on what I call political fragmentation, I was noticing this happening in the U.S., or at least that was my part of my analysis of what was happening with politics in the U.S. Both since then and also just because I became more aware of it, I really saw this as a more pervasive phenomenon across the Western democracies. The evidence for it varies from the PR systems in Western Europe in the first past the post systems. But in the PR systems, there are lots of different ways we could kind of see this fragmentation. Probably the most powerful manifestation of it is in the declining vote share that the traditionally dominant parties and even coalitions of the sort of center right and center left in the European democracies have managed to capture. And instead, what's happened is you see the rise of a whole variety of parties on the left, on the right, of more difficult to characterize ideologies. What it's meant is that you end up in the PR systems with more parties in parliament, with the vote share distributed more broadly across these different parties. The further manifestations of this are that it makes it harder to form governing coalitions. The coalitions take longer to form. They are more unstable. We've seen in some places the need to have multiple national elections to try to find a governing majority. You see governments losing votes of no confidence. And you see the coalitions that do form often being kind of ideologically incoherent. which makes it difficult to have any sense that, that the government that is formed has a kind of a mandate to do specific sorts of things.
And what about the first past the post systems?
So in the US in particular, you do see this in the UK as well, but I think it's more dramatic in the US, partly because the UK political situation had been so dominated by the single issue of Brexit. But what you see is divisions within the parties, which to some extent have, you know, always been there, but the divisions are much harder to manage. Party leaders don't seem to have nearly the same amount of leverage to control these differences and factions within their party. You see many more free agent politicians, as I call them, in the US system in particular. And all of this, particularly in our separated power system, bicameralism as well, makes it even harder to put together majorities to enact legislation on major issues people seem to care most about. And there are a variety of ways, this is actually not the easiest thing to measure, but there are a variety of ways political scientists try to measure how effectively Congress is delivering on the issues that citizens say they care most urgently about. And pretty much whichever measures you use for this, you know, we see declining responsiveness of Congress to what the issues that people, you know, seem to find most urgent. So that's another manifestation of it. And the larger frame here, and I'll stop, you know, with this, but, you know, at the end of the day, my focus is, can Democratic governments deliver effectively on the issues their citizens care most about? And when you have this kind of fragmentation going on in the political structure, it makes it that much harder for governments to do that. There are lots of challenges, I should say, as we all know, that democracies face. And this is one angle, one perspective into some of those challenges. But there are certainly many others that democracies are facing right now.
So one of the things that's most interesting about the article is you provide a kind of a set of causal stories about what has happened. And one of the things I appreciate most about the piece is that it notices that this is a kind of, you need global explanations, not merely domestic ones that focus on, I don't know, like Fox News or something. Could you walk us through the explanations you have for why, you kind of break them up into structural and informational. What are the explanations you give for why political power has fragmented across the West?
Well, let me start with the point that you mentioned, because one of the things that I find very interesting in thinking about these issues is that so many of us who are U.S. focused, you know, tend to think that the particular things we see going on here are a product of very specific things in the way the election system is designed in the U.S. or other factors about the U.S. But what I want to try to do here is situate what is going on in the U.S. in the larger framework of some analysis of what's going on with Western democracies. And it's particularly hard for people to see that, I think, precisely because with first past the post elections versus PR systems, these underlying structural forces get expressed differently. And so it's easy to miss the extent to which something similar seems to be going on across the Western democracies. Now, in terms of, you know, the larger, trying to get a handle on the larger structural forces driving this, I talk about two or three things. I'll tell you about the one I find most interesting last. But, you know, the first couple are somewhat more obvious, and I'm not sure I have a lot that's original to contribute on that. But, you know, in the economic sphere, you know, the combination of the economic effects of globalization on middle and working class voters in the West, the financial crisis meltdown in 2008 is a huge factor in all of this, and I think not actually sufficiently appreciated. And that's all connected to, you know, the rise of increasing income inequality, the transition to a knowledge-based economy in a lot of the West, the areas that get left behind in that. But let me just say something about on the economic sphere, on the 2008 financial crisis, because I find this quite interesting. There was a great study done by a group of economists looking at financial crises since 1870 in democracies. And they find this very strong pattern. The aftermath of financial crises in a decade or so later tends to be something like a 30% increase in the vote share of more populist parties. They may be on the right, they may be on the left. And the explanation for this that they offer is that financial crises are culturally received in a very different way than economic recessions. So with financial crises, there are a couple of things that are distinct. We know they're longer lasting, typically, by the way, than economic recessions, but they seem to be more caused by human agency. You know, it's financial institutions taking risks that that come home to roost, and there may be underlying policy choices that have, you know, encouraged them to take risks when the cost of those risks, if they come home, can be socialized. As opposed to being borne by those institutions. And because governments feel a need, I think somewhat understandably, you know, to come to the rescue of these risk-taking institutions, to bail them out so that they don't take down the rest of the economy, there's tremendous anger and resentment and much more of a sense of political choices and choices of the financial institutions and their leadership that have produced this situation that leads to a kind of anger, resentment, rage, and that's why you see this kind of political effect fairly regularly with respect to financial crisis and not economic crisis. So I just wanted to mention that, because when we talk about the economic forces driving the search for alternatives to the traditional, you know, political leadership, the traditional political parties, whether they're on the right or on the left, I think that's a very significant thing to take into account, as well as globalization, which is sort of the backdrop, of course, into which the financial crisis then kind of unscrambles things even further. On the cultural side, you know, there are somewhat different kind of axes of cultural conflict in different democracies, but the immigration issue is one that you see repeatedly across a lot of these democracies. Of course, in Europe, you know, that issue became much more salient with the Syrian refugees and Angela Merkel's decision in Germany. And in the U.S., of course, with the rates of immigration now approaching 15% of the U.S. population. When last time we were there was when it triggered the kind of nativist reaction against immigration in the 19th century. And I think, you know, you can see this in historical kind of perspective as unleashing a similar kind of dynamic here. So I don't, as I said, and, you know, there are all the standard issues about the way the political parties have now become reorganized across the West. And this is really such a profound transformation that, you know, as Piketty has been teaching us for a while now, it used to be that the parties of the left since World War II in Europe and in the U.S. with the New Deal going back even earlier, that the parties of the left tend to have their base in the sort of lower income part of the distribution, lower educational levels, parties of the right, high education, much more affluent voters. And this is really inverting. And this is the most profound transformation in the structure of how politics gets organized through the parties that we've had since World War II.
Can I just, can I ask a question directly about that since you teed it up? No. So first, thanks for coming on. And it's an amazing paper. You know, I got really exasperated, you know, in the American debates of 2016 through 20, because it seemed like mono-causality on steroids. And, you know, no one would accept that there might be multi-causality. And one of the kind of refreshing and responsible things about the paper is that it offers a list. There are three structural sections, and then we'll get later into the informational stuff. But on the other hand, I mean, you've just pointed out that there seems to be this really profound structural transformation, and that we used to have class divides that were represented by parties and fought out between them. And I mean, your point that you made earlier about the crisis of the center right is well taken, but you know, the center left parties, especially in places like France or the UK, have just cratered. And we have seen center right parties, you know, at least thrive in places like Germany. And so I'm wondering if, you know, with all, you know, with respect for the kind of like multiplication of causes, whether we also need to relate, some things on the list of causes to this very basic point you've just made about the disappearance of class. And, you know, the immigration one is a good example. Why not interpret, you know, immigration concern as, you know, the way the left has traditionally interpreted it, like the socialism of fools, you know, people who end up scapegoating outsiders, you know, Jews historically, others now, because that's how they express what is in effect, you know, a response to class rule, when they don't have a party kind of representing them, representing their economic interests. So, I mean, could you give us a sense of whether we can, you know, connect the things that are on your list of causes to one another in that way? And if not, why not?
So let me take an initial crack at that, but let me know if this is not fully responsive, because I'm not sure if it is. The immigration issue was always, I think, both sort of economic and cultural. And if you think about it in the US in particular, you know, it used to be not that long ago, basically until I would say maybe the 90s, that it was the parties of the Democratic Party, in which union members, you know, were very, very significant players. The unions were always hostile to immigration. They saw it as, you know, threatening their economic position. And there was also a cultural dimension to it then. And so this was a position of the Democratic Party in the United States when Bernie Sanders, by the way, as I mentioned in the paper, you know, even
the Koch brothers comment.
Yeah. I mean, Bernie Sanders absolutely represented all the way up until 2016, the traditional Democratic union view about immigration, which is they're going to drive your wages down to $3 an hour. And so we have to stop it. We need to protect American workers. So now that the immigration issue is the issue of the Republican Party, but it's also connected to the economic side as well, because as we said, you know, the base of the Republican Party has shifted to being working class, you know, predominantly white working class voters, along with the less kind of affluent and the less highly educated. I'm not sure if that answers your or begins to answer your question, but immigration is definitely an issue that cuts across the cultural, economic kind of divide.
Right. I mean, I guess a lot would depend on, you know, how economically rational we think it is to fear immigration if you're, you know, you're class stagnant or whatever. And I assume most of us think it's not very economically rational. And yet we see right populist parties able to play substantially on it. And as you note, I mean, it used to be, you know, more common on the left to try to win support, especially if you had a union base, and that's evaporated. But the right has very successfully played on it in all these countries, even in places like Hungary, where, you know, there are literally no immigrants from the Syrian refugee crisis being allowed in.
Right. One of the things that's interesting about the European political situation, which you see a little bit here, but not nearly as much, is how much the main political parties of both the center right and the center left have moved right on immigration in response to the cultural politics that they became aware of on immigration. And, you know, as I assume you know, that in most of these European countries, immigration was actually not something that either of the major parties particularly wanted to talk about and make a political issue. And that's part of why there has been the rise of some of these third and fourth insurgent parties, because they were forcing the immigration issue into politics in a way that the major parties didn't want to confront it. So it's had a huge effect on both the parties of the center left and the center right in Europe. In the US, I think people forget this a bit, but President Obama was certainly very attuned to this issue. And as you may remember, he was very aggressive, more aggressive than any president had been in deporting people who were here, who were unauthorized. You know, it was a subset, obviously, but 400,000 people a year he was deporting. Right. And critics called him the deporter in chief.
Correct.
And so that was a little bit of a sign of how this issue was affecting the Democratic Party, at least temporarily. Now, that went away over the next 8 years or so. But you see that issue dramatically affecting the positioning of the parties in Europe, on both on the left and on the right. Now, whether any of these views are rational, I mean, we could debate that as a separate matter, but I'm just trying to understand.
Right. Understood.
What are these political dynamics? What seems to be driving this fragmentation that we're seeing across these democracies?
Okay, so let me ask a kind of related question, because and it goes back to my original comment that when you kind of are multiplying causal factors, and one could begin to wonder, well, what's not participating in fragmentation? And I just want to throw out something that is in a sense present by its absence, and that's race. And maybe that's because you are taking a kind of multinational look. I just searched, and race is really not mentioned. I mean, there's one occurrence in the paper, and one could infer that you think that the principal role of race in American fragmentation has been to slow the defection of working class voters from the Democrats that you would ordinarily expect looking at other cases, but not playing any larger role of the kind it's been assigned in so many analyses of Donald Trump and so forth. So is that a correct read of your perspective, or do you want to say something more generally about the role of race in American fragmentation?
Yeah, so let me start with the point you mentioned, just to make sure people listening understand this point. So one reason the Democratic Party has managed to do somewhat better than a lot of the parties of the left in Europe through this period of fragmentation and over the last decade, although the Democratic Party is, just marginally in control, in the House and the Senate, but they're doing better than a lot of their analog parties on the left in the European democracies. And I think a significant reason for that is that we have significant groups of voters who are not voting as working class voters because African-Americans are number one. That's been true of Hispanics as well, although that seems to be breaking down a little bit now. But because of the history of politics around the issue of race in the United States and the relationship of the two political parties to that issue, African-American voters are still, overwhelmingly Democratic, even if they're working class, and a very large percentage of Hispanic voters, even though they're working class. And so that gives a ballast to the party of the left in the U.S. that a lot of the parties of the left in Europe don't have. That's a fair question, and I probably should think about that more, as I work on revising the paper. Obviously in the US, it's a huge part of the cultural dynamics around the transformation of the parties. And I guess I'm less confident. I mean, I think you're right that, I've been less confident that apart from immigration, there's an independent contributor along that dimension in the European democracies. And I think that's why the paper doesn't really engage that issue so directly, because it does seem like it is really relatively unique to this dynamic in the United States. But I think it's a fair question.
Yeah. So I want us to get at some point to back to the other type of causal story, which is about kind of information technology, which I found extremely convincing. But I have questions about the structural side too. And so I just want to throw them out there while I have them, while we're talking about it, which is, I've got two questions. One is that maybe the explanation should be bigger than you suggest. And the other one is that maybe it should be smaller. And I'm going to ask the bigger and then the smaller. And so the bigger one is that you date the kind of weirding of politics to the late 1990s, give or take. But I wonder, particularly in the American context, whether we could date it even earlier to the 1970s, the breakdown of the parties really begins in the post-Watergate era. And one thing that's notable about this, and you start seeing some weird things happening in some European democracies at the same time, is that this is when, as Robert Gordon argues, the kind of global period of fast economic growth ends, that we have 100 years of relatively fast economic growth, historically fast economic growth from 1870 to 1970. And then, depending on where you are, this slows and then stops. And he doesn't argue that policy drove this. It was just like the how good our ideas were. We had a set of idea, general purpose technology that's developed that did a lot of good stuff. And then we've had slower growth since. So my question is, is it just that we've in an era of diminished global ambition, of less fast growth of both median but also high end income, not relative but like overall growth, that when things aren't going well, people get angry and get weird.
So there's no doubt that the slower growth rates after the early 1970s. Had effects on politics, and certain of these, fissures you can see maybe beginning to kind of develop. I don't know so much if that's true in the European democracies in the same way it is here. And I confess, not to knowing the kind of the history of this, the economic contraction in Europe after 73 or so roughly. And how much of an effect it was beginning to show, but most things have longer histories if you really peel back the layers, but you don't see anything like the dramatic effects on the organization of politics that we've seen over the last 10 years or so, 10 to 15 years. I don't know exactly how to date it, and it's also like there's this simmering, backdrop, if you will, take globalization in the U.S. There's no question that with globalization in the U.S. And particularly in the decade starting in 2000, where you see this massive decline in the manufacturing sector, with one third of all manufacturing jobs being lost in that decade in the U.S. with the ascension of China to the WTO. You see the withdrawal, the alienation, you see these forces beginning to build. And that's certainly a latent factor, or not so latent. But then when you add on top of it something that really sort of lights a match to that, which is the financial crisis in 2008, it's these things working kind of together. So yes, there are things that are going on over a longer period of time that are not as dramatic as a single moment, like the financial crisis, the meltdown of the financial sector, and the government bailouts. But in any event, there's no question that starting in the 1970s, you begin to see, these changing growth rates in the West. And of course, that does begin to affect politics. Nothing makes for a better political dynamic than significant increases in GDP growth. That tends to, we can argue about how it's distributed, but it makes a lot of things in politics a lot easier when you have 5% growth rates rather than 1.5% growth rates.
So I also wanted to ask, I said the bigger, but also a narrower one. It's kind of the opposite of the determinist type of story I just offered, which is that the realm of ideas may have some kind of independent factor. So I'm pretty sure you know and work with Hans Noel's work. And he argues that in the United States, before the parties decide to become liberal and conservative, that editorial pages kind of polarized, grouping together not necessarily obvious combinations of kind of people being pro-choice on abortion and pro-higher taxes. And they coalesced in editorial pages because ideology had kind of an independent force and people were working their way through, of course, influenced by structural factors, but also that. So to what extent do you think there is also, in addition to the structural force you think that you're talking about, kind of a global intellectual trend towards nationalism that may be related to structural forces, but is in some ways independent of it? It's just things that scribblers are saying and that, that is telling some of the story as well. Because you do structural and then you do technological, but there's no space for, like, I don't know, idea and coalition merchants in your story.
Yeah, so it's always hard to disentangle, structural factors and ideological or realm of idea kind of factors reshaping how political elites, political parties, political leaders, initially at least, begin to think about issues. So, take the fact that in the 90s, you have all of the major sort of parties of the left, whether it's Schroeder in Germany, Clinton here, or, Blair in the UK. And they're all kind of coming to the view that the parties of the left need to shift towards more in the free trade direction, more in the open, more accessible for immigration, for immigrants. Now, why did they all come to that view at that time? The parties of the left had been out of power in all those countries for very extended periods of time. So they're desperate. They're searching for new effective electoral strategies. And they were ripe. They gained power and many of them held power for a significant period of time after this transformation. But how do you disentangle the realm of ideas and debates about these issues versus the structural imperatives of we've got to find voters who will support us? I don't begin to know how you would really untangle those threads. So I'm sure it's true that, we could do a lot more trying to work through the realm of ideas and how it factors into all of these transformations that we see over this period of time.
So let's turn to this, the kind of other big pillar, of the analysis, which is about information. So could you just kind of tell us what you say in that section?
I have to say, this is a part of the piece I like quite a lot and find I'm most engaged with in some ways at this point, which is, we've had obviously lots of conversation about the communications revolution. And I want to put it that way because I think cable television is extremely important here, along with the internet and social media. It's not just the internet and social media.
And talk radio.
Yeah, and talk radio, which in the US at least, which I probably should say more about. But we're very familiar now in the lapsed state we now exist in with respect to the communications revolution, that we no longer have this utopian, optimistic, kind of understanding of how it's going to transform the world. We're very aware of these issues of disinformation and misinformation and incitement to violence and offensive speech and all these kinds of issues. And my view is that even if we could get a handle on all those issues, which I doubt we can, whether it's through, platform self-regulation or government regulation, even if those issues could somehow be solved, I don't think we appreciate how challenging the communications revolution is for democratic systems, for democratic governments. And that's because it's basically so destabilizing inherently of political authority, along with authority in lots of other dimensions, or other realms. And it's inherently, I think, delegitimating in many ways also. This has been expressed again somewhat differently in Europe than in the US, but I see similarities at work as well, even though the surface expressions are somewhat different. And I think that at some very profound level, I wonder whether the communications revolution is just going to make it incredibly difficult for Democratic governments to marshal the kind of concerted, sustained authority you need to develop programs, to push through controversial programs, to sustain these programs, because of how destabilizing the technology makes things. But I think it's really dramatic in the US in particular forms, because we already start off with a system in which our politicians are somewhat more individual actors than in the European democracies. You know, our politicians stand for primary elections. That's how they get chosen to be nominated. The parties don't choose them. They have to raise money because we don't have public financing. So we start from that. But what the internet has now made possible, and I think we all know this, whether we see it clearly or not, it's enabled politicians at the very, in their first years in office even, to be incredibly independent actors. And they're able to do this because they can attract a national constituency or a large enough national constituency between social media and cable. You know, AOC, of course, is the kind of clear example of this. As I mentioned, the paper, she comes into Congress with something like 9 million followers on the relevant platforms, Twitter, Instagram, et cetera. And it just dwarfs any other Democratic politician. And so she can immediately reach 9 million people. And on top of it, they're now able to raise funds through the internet with very low transactions costs, and mainly by raising money through small donors. And that enables them to stand somewhat independently of their party leaders. Ted Cruz, when he first came into the Senate, was a great example of this. I mean, he was incredibly disruptive to the Republican Party. He saw it in his interest, as it turned out to be in many ways politically, to stand against the party constantly and to do things that were not in the interest of the party, at least as the Republican Party leadership understood it. But he could do that because they no longer need to work their way up through the party by getting onto being there long enough and you know, serving the party's interests to get on important committees and then get more of a platform, and then they're able to be more visible and raise money. Now you see them going in. Marjorie Taylor Greene obviously is another clear example of this. She raises very large amounts of money on the internet. In fact, when Congress removed her from her committee chairs, in the next 3 months, she raised as much money as anybody had raised in a quarter. The manifestation, one manifestation of the communications revolution on politics in the US is the loss of control that party leaders once had over their members. And again, in the US system, it takes a lot of compromising and a lot of difficult choices to actually get legislation through this complicated system. And when party leaders don't have the leverage to be able to force members who are recalcitrant to take votes that they don't want to take, but the party leaders believe is in the interest of the party as a whole, you know, the more fragmented Congress is, the harder it is to put together the concerted authority to enable government to legislate, to act effectively.
Yeah. One of the things I thought was interesting about this, and something I've written a little bit about also, is that this phenomenon in the United States of is one of the reasons why we still have a two-party system, whereas all the other first-past-the-post systems have moved away from to having real two-party system. Canada doesn't have a two-party system. Britain, depending on how you think about it, doesn't have a two-party system. But in our system, every weirdo who would be a third party just runs in a primary, like Donald Trump, you know, just runs in a primary rather than running in a general, than running as an independent.
But, you know, just to stay at the U.S. example, so on the Republican Party side, as I mentioned in the paper, let's not forget, you know, when the Republicans were in control of the House, two of their own speakers of the House gave up the position because it was impossible for them to control their coalition or their caucus. I mean, that's really incredible. And I read John Boehner's memoir, and a lot of his memoir is about his inability to control what he calls the Chaos Caucus or the Insurgent Caucus.
Impossible to read that book and not drink red wine. It's a scientific impossibility to read that book and not have a drink a glass of red wine like he has the whole time.
And on the, you know, on the Democratic side, you know, it hasn't quite gotten to that point, but you see the, you know, the incredible tensions between the moderate and progressive sides of the party and how that's affecting their ability to actually legislate and how being tied up in these internal conflicts that party leaders have less capacity to resolve is probably hurting the party overall. And contributing to Biden's, you know, low favorability ratings. And it's partly a result of this fragmentation. Now, as I said before, we've had fragmented parties. I mean, they haven't been like these solid unified blocks, but party leaders, they're, let's get probably more complicated than we need here, but there are two things that were different. In the past, the fragmentation was more towards the center. So you could put together coalitions of Democrats and Republicans to legislate. There was bipartisan legislation, even with these divisions within the party. That's not true now. And party leaders had more ability to kind of make deals go through. And my perception is they just lost a tremendous amount of that capacity. And I think they testify themselves to that. You know, and so now that in Europe, it's different because the parties generally have more control over their members in parliament. But one of the things, of course, we've seen with the communications revolution is how easy it is to mobilize almost spontaneously large groups of opposition, whether it's the Yellow Vests in France or the Indignados in Spain or the Canadian truckers now recently in, you know, Canada. And I was really struck with the example of Macron, who, you know, came in kind of disrupting the traditional party configurations in France. And, you know, as soon as he starts trying to make policy, the Yellow Vest protest emerges to the point where they actually keep him invisible for a significant period of time, months and months and months, because anywhere he appears, he's immediately met with these movements that get organized and can be put together very quickly. And so you see how disruptive that is. Now, there are good things to this disruption as well as bad things. And
well, can I ask about that? I mean, because I absolutely love this section of the paper and it's so educational. But the kind of, you know, really the entire paper, but this section is it you is suffused with worry, and I'm just not sure. So you fear delegitimation and especially interference with enough hierarchy at, you know, at the top of parties to function in ways that are familiar to us. However, you know, there's a really interesting moment in the paper where you say, look, delegitimation brought down the old regime. And, you know, you could go much further with that. You know, a lot, there are much bigger theories than the one you mentioned about how the coming of print changes politics for good and in profound ways over a few centuries. And I just assume that that's going to happen. And yet the perspective of the paper is, this is different because we really can't have democracy or we can't have party democracy in the way that's familiar to us if this keeps going. And so, like, there are a few questions. First, so what? We'll have something else. And, you know, even if you think it's going to be worse, maybe it's inevitable in the way that, looking back, there was no spitting in the wind of the print revolution. And the same may be true of this one. So give us a sense of, like, what's so bad about the delegitimation of the current way we, you know, have established authorities in politics and, let's say, a more decentralized populist era of, you know, fighting the ongoing civil war that politics has always been.
Yeah, so I think those are really rich and terrific questions, and you certainly pick up on the tone in the paper, you know, correctly. So, you know, the first thing to say, which is obvious, I think, is that, you know, delegitimating authority can be a good thing depending on the nature of the authority that's being exercised. There's nothing at all inherently wrong, to much to the contrary. Some authority needs to be delegitimated. But if delegitimation is a perpetual, continuous kind of nature fact of about the nature of our politics, no matter what the authorities are doing or what they're trying to do, you know, I think that's what I'm trying to kind of put my finger on. Number one. Now, number two, you say, well, so what? You know, maybe we'll adapt to all of this. We don't know what it will look like, and maybe it will be fine. And you know, I obviously can't answer that cheery, you know, kind of perspective in some, you know, knockdown way. The worry I have, obviously, is, as the paper, you know, says throughout, is when governments, if in fact this dynamic makes it far more difficult for governments to deliver effectively on the issues that people care about, democratic governments, people will get alienated from their governments at a minimum. Distrust will, you know, increase. Anger may increase. There can, it's easy to see. In fact, this is part of what we know, is that the failure, the inability of democratic governments to seem to function effectively can produce a longing for a kind of authoritarian strongman figure to cut through all of this dysfunction. You know, I alone can make things work. And I think with the rise of China, you know, as a kind of model now of authoritarian capitalism that, for all the horrible things going on, seems to be delivering, you know, prosperity to people. Joe Biden is clearly aware of this challenge, ideologically, if you will, culturally, that, you know, rising China poses. I just worry that if, in fact, this makes it so much more difficult for democratic governments to function effectively, that's a path one has to be concerned about. I also think in a lot of the academic writing on democracy and a lot of the reform, you know, kind of advocacy, at least in the U.S. about democracy, I think people, there's a real neglect of the fact that you need to, at the end of the day, organize political power. It needs to be, for it to be effective. We are going to need organization. We are going to need the things that go with effective organization. It's hard for me to see how that doesn't run through political parties. Maybe the parties, you know, look different in various sorts of ways. But if parties can't be effective in organizing the political domain, then I do worry that it will really hamstring the ability of democratic governments to function effectively, to deliver effectively, and that does raise serious concerns.
Totally.
And sort of this vision of this perpetual turbulence, destabilization, lots of participation, because we can all participate, you know, in these, however meaningful you think these forms of participation are, you know, tweeting things out.
I follow AOC.
What do you mean, you're a follower?
I follow her on Twitter since you referenced her massive. Okay,
And she's a master of that medium, right?
She is. No, extraordinary on social media. Okay, so I wasn't trying to be cheery. I was just more saying that, you know, a lot of people at the time of the delegitimation of monarchy had a similar freak out. And yet we know, we believe as its heirs, that it was actually a good thing to transition to a new form of politics of the kind that, you know, of which you're a theorist. And who knows, you know, whether we could try to imagine some successor form to party democracy, especially given that, as you say, that we're not going back. Okay, but the other question I want to ask really connects this part of the paper to the rest. And it's about remedies, because when you do think about remedies, it's kind of interesting, maybe revealing, that they're just about the communications part of the paper. And yet I would have thought that reading the first structural part of the paper, that the central task is some kind of party realignment where we get a working class party back. And of course, that's going to be connected to, you know, whatever the communications revolution ends up bringing us. But that, you know, it seems like the structural part of the paper suggests that we're hostage to this class de-alignment across different, you know, countries, and the working class doesn't have a party, et cetera. And so, I mean, why not think in that way? Because when you get to remedies, you don't. Instead, you focus, let's say, exclusively on communications reform.
Yeah. Well, I have been inclined to think that the remedies, I'm even a little bit reluctant to use that word, but because it's such a big thing you're trying to kind of repair, right, if you will, but or envision kind of going forward. So I think what we're hoping for, or what we probably need to hope for, is that enough consensus emerges on some of these large issues that governments can actually be empowered to deal with them. Now, we don't know what shape that consensus will be, and if it's a consensus that's more on the right or on the left. But the question to me, then, the questions are, well, what kinds of things might lead to that enough of a consensus being formed that the governments actually that can go into office and actually do something that people think is serving their interests, or enough people think is serving their interests. Maybe what's going on with Ukraine and the war there now, which is no question going to have profound effects on democratic politics in the West, and it's going to, it may lead to reorganization of politics in various ways. You see this most dramatically already in Germany, you know, of course, where, you know, you have the Green Party saying, yes, we have to militarize. And you have the Libertarian Party saying, yes, we need to spend this kind of money. So an external shock of that magnitude, and now we have one staring us right in the face, could certainly scramble up and lead to some solidification along different lines that would have enough consensus behind it that these governments will then be able to act on some of the major issues. Or it could be that, the political parties or large political parties or new parties that become very significant, the Brexit Party emerging out of kind of very little and becoming such a powerful force in UK politics is an example. But maybe political figures will figure out a way to generate internally enough of the consensus. They will win over enough voters to be able to have the ability to actually then deliver in governance. What kinds of trade-offs would the parties have to make? As I said earlier, you see the parties on the left and on the center right in Europe becoming much harsher on immigration issues. And, you know, maybe, and I actually do think that issue has become less salient in a lot of these European democracies, partly because we're further away from the really large influx of the Syrian refugees, the 1.5 million or whatever the exact number was, but also because the parties have been willing to address the issue in a way they hadn't been, and they are moving in that direction. And I think that is suppressing the immigration issue a bit. There's a consensus, you know, that's moved to the right on that. So whether moves like that, you know, will then enable governments to go into power that have some sort of broader consensus behind them, because with that issue behind them, it's easier to address certain economic, political kinds of issues. But I don't really have any kind of off the rack, you know, sort of
fair. So I mean, would it be fair then to say that it's countermeasures you use, not remedies, in fairness? That part of the paper, you sort of think, you know, as an expert in democracy, it's important to focus there for kind of then enabling politicians to reforge consensus on the structural issues on which you have not much to say, because you could imagine different outcomes there. Is that the kind of logic of the paper?
I think that's correct. Yes. And those examples I offer at the very end of the paper on countermeasures in the U.S., I mean, they're really very marginal examples. I mean, they're interesting. I think they're interesting to see and understand in light of what we've been talking about, you know, throughout the talk and what the paper addresses. For example, I mentioned the fact that, you know, as most people understand who study Congress, you know, lawmaking has become a much more centralized process in Congress. And a lot of people decry that because it makes the committee process less meaningful. And, you know, there are views about why that's a better process. But what a lot of people who criticize that, and just people who write about it, don't understand is how much the centralization of lawmaking in Congress is a response to these forces of fragmentation. And so when you use the older traditional form of lawmaking in Congress, you know, through the committee process, it just enables so much more destabilization of the effort to get packages through than even in the past, that this is a response of the political actors inside the system. We'll centralize this. We'll do it in, you know, closed door session as much as possible. We'll figure out the overall agreement, and then we'll just try to get our members to vote for it, even if they dislike that process. But I don't think of that. I think these are interesting developments to see in this light. I don't think they are major forces that are going to fundamentally change the dynamics of fragmentation and put this back in a bottle where it's all nicely manageable. And that's just within the political class, as you said, the elected people in Congress. That's just a small thing there. I don't know if we could identify similar things going on in some of the Western democracies. I'm not sure I've, you know, sort of thought about them through this lens, because I wasn't really in this very excessively long paper that no law review will publish because it's too long. Maybe my only option is to turn it into a book, but.
Well, hopefully they publish it after they hear about it on Digging a Hole, the Legal Theory podcast.
What's your advertising base?
There you go. This will be a test case. Maybe if effort to get succeeds, we'll be able to sell it to other authors or law journals. This is where I wanted to follow up, which is one of the things you say is that this party breakdown leads to an inability to substantively respond to, like, the cause of bad policy is this broken politics. And that's where I kind of wanted to push you. So on one side, take the United States. Over the last couple of years, we had probably was considered to be the first in class macroeconomic policy response in Congress, the huge stimulus and whatever, despite our heavily polarized system. And on the other side, I live in New York City, which is a one-party city in a one-party state these days. And New York City and New York State are a governance disaster. The cost of producing a single kilometer of subway is multiples higher than is anywhere in the world. If you walk outside of your house, there's trash everywhere. To what extent do we really think that, I mean, you could tell those stories as a cause of being caused by fragmentation, the inability to build housing caused by excessive litigation risk or accessibility through community meetings or something, but it's not the same story you're telling about party democracy. To what extent what evidence would you use to support the idea that it is the breakdown in parties that's leading to a breakdown in policy? Because you could tell a story that goes the other way, which is that national policy, despite all of our fighting, is basically where people want it. And the dismantling of politics is caused by the fact that there aren't these dramatic war and peace or type questions. So to what extent are you convinced that or convince me that party, the fragmentation of political party is the causal source of inability to provide policies people want, when we see governments not able to provide policies people want in places that don't have such a breakdown.
Well, your comment about one party jurisdictions, helps kind of point out that, of course, we want competition in politics. We don't want political monopolies. They're not good generally. But too much competition can also become a problem, or at least competition organized in certain ways rather than other ways can become a problem, because at the end of the day, you do need concerted authority, especially in the kind of system we have, to be able to deliver. I'm surprised by your comment that policy is, seems to be where people want it. Everything you look at, right, shows tremendous dissatisfaction with American government, all the survey data and that we've had for quite a while, and increasing dissatisfaction. So we have been able to deliver certain things.
But often that unhappiness is a status quo, and hands off my Medicare, or government hands off my Medicare, is a status quo unhappiness, not a.
There can be that. But I think it's hard to look at the situation in the US and look at politics more generally across the West and think that citizens are fundamentally content with how their governments are performing.
Quickly follow up. I'm not sure about this. I'm kind of asking you to help me out, but it's one possibility is that their unhappiness is caused by it's a post-materialist politics. That's the way that some people put it, which is that people are their basic needs are met, and therefore what they're angry about is Colin Kaepernick or whatever, and it's not about Medicare.
Yeah, and so what follows from that? That governments can't possibly deliver in a way that large numbers of people are going to find satisfying, because if they're cultural conflicts, they're kind of zero sum, if you will.
Yeah, I'm not offering this as an argument so much as offering a chance for you to reflect on.
No, there's no question that in the more affluent democracies, the cultural issues. The salience of cultural issues to economic issues has changed with increasing prosperity. And that's not just true in the US, that there's good evidence for that across the Western democracies.
Yeah, I just thought Sam had taken my role as the podcast resident optimist, and I couldn't allow for that. So we have to stay in character. So I want one quick chance for you to kind of follow up on, because in addition to this kind of big theoretical work, you're also doing some quite on the ground work that is currently in front of Congress. And so could you just give us a couple of minutes, because I'm fascinated by it, on your work on and your kind of big fight you're having with other people on reforming the Electoral College process, and kind of why are you right and Mark Elias is wrong?
I'm focused on political reform across a lot of different areas. So it may seem silly in the context of these huge forces that we're talking about, to deal with concrete institutional reform, but I am a big
just the opposite.
Particularly in recent years, I've become very focused on what I call political reforms to mitigate or combat extremism in American politics. Now, this is a very American-centric set of issues at this point, but this is much broader than Electoral Count Act reform. So it has to do, the things I'm focused on are changes to the way the primary elections are structured, because I think primary elections in the U.S. and the fear of being primaried are a major factor driving politics to an even more extreme place, that more factional candidates are able to get elected in the structure that we have, as opposed to candidates who have broader kind of electoral appeal. So primary election reform is something I'm spending a lot of time on. I think that although, the horse is out of the barn on this, but I've thought that going into this round of redistricting in the United States, It's very important to put the emphasis on creating competitive election districts to the extent we can. We can't do it, you know, across the board by any means at all. But I think competitive districts do tend to generate candidates who have to be more responsive to the center of the electorate, as opposed to candidates who are in safe seats and never worry about a general election, and all they worry about is being primary. Now, unfortunately, one of the themes of this round of redistricting is the decimation of competitive election districts in Congress. We actually only had about 10 to 15% of districts that were competitive going into this round of redistricting. Now it looks like we're going to have half of that. And so you're going to see what you're going to see the effects on politics of 90 some percent of members in Congress, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, coming from safe seats where they face, going back to your point, no competitive pressure in the general election. I think the way we finance elections or possible new ways of financing elections can contribute to extremism or mitigate it. I've been one of the sort of loudest or strongest critics of the reform idea. And I understand the appeal of the idea of providing public matching funds for small donations to candidates. You know, that has an appeal because it promotes a more egalitarian kind of system of public financing and more participation. But what we know is that all the dynamics of fundraising on the internet are the same as all the other dynamics on the internet, which is the more outrageous, the more extreme, the more attention you draw, and the more small donations you draw. I'm very worried if we were to do that at the national level, that we would be fueling extremism even more so.
Huge effects on polarization.
Yeah, and I have views about the presidential nominations process. And by the way, if, you know, in all the sort of questions people have asked about, you know, how should we design our system? How did Donald Trump become possible? A candidate like Donald Trump. I think if we had not changed the way we structured choosing nominees for the presidency for the major parties in the 1970s, when we went to the current system of all primary elections for doing this, as opposed to the system that had been used for 170 years or so before, in which party elected officials throughout the country had significant influence, as well as voters to an extent. But anyway, we went to a high, you know, completely populist system for choosing these nominees. No surprise, more populist type candidates do better in that system. Anyway, those are all kind of political reforms that I think could help to mitigate extremism or the forces of extremism. The Electoral Count Act reform is a much more narrow, specific issue, but I think a very important one in light of all the vulnerabilities in our system that got exposed in 2020 to trying to minimize the risk that partisan manipulation, whether it's in the states or in Congress, could lead the presidential election result to not actually reflect the votes of voters. And it's a tricky project because we now are in a culture of pervasive institutional distrust in the election arena, and for good reason. You know, there's distrust of what Congress might do. There's distrust of what state legislatures might do. There's distrust of what governors or secretaries of state might do. Anyway, Electoral Count Act reform is trying to deal with the risk of election subversion, as we call it. And so that's another area which I'm focused on. So it's kind of, you know, the paper is at the broadest possible level, and then I'm drilling down on all these very kind of specific issues.
Yeah. I think it's terrific. Superdelegates and soft money FTW, as far as I'm concerned. But it's a it's a you and me baby alone on this one. And I think it's great work. And so thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This was so much fun. And the thank paper you, is so Rick. Terrific.
Also, it's great to have the illusion that anyone but beyond the three of us are actually, you know, engaged in this discussion.
Our vast influential thousands audience.
Thousands.
Our vast influential audience. Will,
our tentacles so extend much, everywhere.
So much fun. You know, this is so much fun. Thank you for inviting me to do it. And yeah, I'll have to figure out what to do with this paper ultimately. So any thoughts on that?
Yes. What you should do with it is you should, is that all of our listeners should accept it into your law journals.
It's too late for that anyway.
It's a total banger. So, with that, we're going to say goodbye. So thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thanks. It was fun. Bye.